I had other guests to worry about that week, namely a middle-aged couple here for their 25th wedding anniversary. It would have been our first booking through the new internet advertisement, had the Mobys not already been fully booked, forcing Liza to take them out instead. That alone would have put her in a bad mood. She had been adamant that she would play no part in the internet business. But the man complained about everything. The room wasn't big enough, the furnishings were shabby, the shower smelt of mildew. On his first two mornings, he finished the box of bran flakes, and when I set out a fresh box the next day, he complained I hadn't given him a choice. To cap it, he complained that Liza had set off late on their whale-watching trip, even though they'd arrived late at the jetty, because he had been determined to look round the Whale Chasers Museum and had made me open it specially. It was included in the price, you see. His wife, an elegant woman, immaculately put together, in the way that makes me wonder about the time and effort people are prepared to devote to such things, followed him round, apologising under her breath to everyone he rubbed up the wrong way. The breathless, conspiratorial ease with which she did this suggested it was not a new experience for her. The trip was her anniversary treat, she told me apologetically, glancing behind her to where he was pacing towards the hotel, his head sunk into his shoulders. I wondered how many years it had taken for the deep grooves to appear on her forehead. "He's enjoyed it much more than last year's trip," she said, and I laid a hand on her arm in sympathy. "He was a bully," Liza said when she came in. "If it hadn't been for her, I wouldn't have taken them." We exchanged a look. "Bet you made her day, though."
"Not really. Not a whale anywhere. I gave them an extra hour, but it was like the seas were empty."
"Perhaps they knew."
"I sent out a whale sonar, telling them to bugger off for the day."
Sometimes I can see her mother, my little sister, in Liza. She's there in the way Liza tilts her head when she's thinking, in her thin, strong fingers, in her smile when she sees her daughter. That's when I know my niece's presence here, and Hannah's, is a blessing. That there is an elemental pleasure in seeing the continuation of a family line, a joy that we who are childless might not otherwise experience. It's that jolt of recognition when suddenly you see not only her mother, but your great-uncle Evan, your grandmother, perhaps even yourself. I have been grateful for this knowledge these last 5 years. Those glimpses of familial brow, frown or giggle have made up in some small way for the loss of my sister. Liza, however, has other features. Her watchfulness, the ever-present sadness, the faded white scar where her cheekbone meets her left ear, that are entirely her own. I suppose it should have been of no great surprise to me that Nino Gaines hadn't called by for a few days, not after the way I sent him packing the last time he came. But his unusual show of self-sufficiency got to me. I wouldn't go so far as to say I missed him, but I didn't like the idea that he might be sitting at Barra Creek thinking badly of me. More than anyone, I knew that life was too short for grudges. After lunch, I packed up a lemon cake in greaseproof paper, sat it on the passenger seat of my car, and headed out to his place. It was a beautiful day, the air so clear you could see the mountains in the distance and pick out every needle on the pines that lined the road. It had been an especially dry summer, and as I drove inland, I glanced at the reddish earth, the bony horses with no grass to graze, killing time by swishing their tails at the never-ending flies. The air was different out here. The pollen and dust motes hung static, the atmosphere unfiltered and sullen. I don't understand how people can live inland. I find that endless brown depressing, the solid outline of hill and valley too unchanging. You get used to the moods of the sea, like those of a spouse, I imagine. Over enough years, you may not always like them,
but it's what you know. He was just headed indoors when I pulled up outside. He turned at the sound of my engine, wiping his oversized hands on the back of his trousers, and touched one hand to the brim of his hat when he'd grasped who it was. He was wearing a quilted waistcoat that I swear he'd had back in the 1970s when his two boys were born. I hesitated before I got out of the car. We had rarely fallen out, and I was not entirely sure of my reception. We stood squinting at each other, and I remember thinking how ridiculous we were, two brittle old skeletons facing each other like teenagers. "Afternoon," I said. "Come for your order?" he asked. But there was a twinkle in his eye that made me relax, a twinkle that, if I'm honest, I didn't deserve. "I brought you a cake," I said, reaching back into the car to get it. "I hope it's lemon." "Why? Are you going to send it back if it's not?"
"I might."
"I don't remember you as picky, Nino Gaines. Stubborn, greedy and rude, yes. Picky, no."
"You've got lipstick on."
"Over-familiar, too." He grinned at me, and I couldn't quite keep the smile from my face. That's what they don't tell you about old age. It doesn't stop you acting like a young fool.
"Come on in, Kathleen. I'll see if I can get stubborn, greedy and over-familiar Mark too to make us both a cup of tea. You look very nice, by the way."
The first time Nino Gaines asked me to marry him, I was 19 years old. The second time, I was 19 and 2 weeks. The third time was 42 years later. This was not due to any lapse in memory or attention on his part, but because in the intervening years, having given up on me, he was married to Jean. He met her 2 months after I'd turned him down for the second time, when she disembarked at Woolloomooloo from a bride ship, having changed her mind about the soldier she was due to marry. He had been waiting for an old friend on the docks, found his gaze drawn to her wasp waist and crooked nylons, and, like the force of nature she was, she had reeled him in and got a ring firmly on her finger before another 2 months were out. Many people thought they were a strange couple. They used to fight like billy-o. But he brought her back to his newly purchased vineyard at Barra Creek, and they were together until she died at the age of 57 from cancer. It didn't take a fool to see that, for all their arguments, they were a good match. I don't blame her for her determination. Nino Gaines, it was widely acknowledged back then, was one of the handsomest men in Silver Bay, even wearing a woman's bathing suit. This he did every year, when the servicemen put on a show for the local children. It was a matter of some embarrassment to me that mine was the first he was told to ask for. In the war years, I was a strapping lass, tall and square-shouldered. I'm not a lot smaller now. While other women have shrunk, backs bending like question marks, joints knotting with arthritis and osteoporosis, I'm still pretty upright, my limbs strong enough. I say it's the effort of running the old hotel with its 8 bedrooms and only sporadic help. The crews say that shark cartilage is now famed for its preservative qualities. Their idea of a joke. The first time I laid eyes on him, I was serving at the hotel bar. He strode in wearing his Air Force uniform, appraised me hard enough to make me blush, saw the newspaper picture framed beside the shelves and asked, "Do you bite?" It wasn't the words that got my father's back up, but the wink that went with them. I was such an innocent that it all flew as swiftly over my head as the warplanes that stacked up over Tomory Point. "No," my father said from behind his newspaper by the till. "But her father does." "You want to watch that one?" he said to my mother later. "Got a mouth as smart as a whip cut." And to me, "You stay away from him, you hear?" Back in those days, I thought my father's word was gospel. I kept my exchanges with Nino Gaines to the minimum, tried not to blush too hard when he complimented me on my dresses, stifled my giggles when he cracked secret jokes at me from across the bar. I tried not to notice that he came in every night that he wasn't on duty, even though everyone agreed that the best nightlife was to be found a good 20 minutes' drive up the coast road. My little sister Nora was just 4 at the time. It's fair to say her arrival had been something of a surprise to my parents. And she used to gaze up at him like he was a god, largely because he plied her with chocolate and chewing gum. And then Nino asked me to marry him. Knowing my father's stringent views on servicemen, I had to refuse. We might have been all right, I sometimes think, if the second time he'd asked me, he hadn't done it in front of my father. When Jean died, nearly 15 years ago now, I thought Nino Gaines might collapse into himself and fade away. I've seen it before with men of that age. Their clothes get a little more unkempt, they forget to shave, they start living on packet food. They have a lost quality about them, as if permanently hopeful that someone will step in and take care of them. It was how that generation of men was raised, you see. They never learnt to do anything for themselves. But Frank and John John kept him busy, made sure their father was not alone, set up new projects with this grape and that blend. Frank remained at home, and John John's wife came twice a week and cooked for them. Yes, Nino Gaines did better than any of us had expected. After a year or so, there was little about him to suggest that he had suffered such a blow. Then one night, over a nice bottle of Shiraz Merlot, he confided in me that 2 weeks before she died, Jean had told him she'd celestially box his ears if he moped around by himself when she was gone. There was a long pause after he said this. When I looked up from my glass, he was staring straight at me. That silence burns me now if I think too hard about it. "She was quite right," I said, avoiding his eye. "Be silly for you to mope around. Make sure you get out and about. Go see a few friends up north. Best thing for you." There were other things he said later, but we didn't talk about those anymore. For many years now, Nino had accepted that he and I would never be more than good friends. I treasured his friendship, probably more than he knew, and it was rare that one of us was invited to some event without the other. We had settled into a kind of joke intimacy, a verbal dance that we performed, partly because we both enjoyed sparring, partly because neither of us knew how else to hide the slight awkwardness that existed between us. But it was some years since he had talked to me with any intimacy, which suited us both fine. "Frank was in town yesterday and bumped into Cherry Dawson," he said. I had been staring at his placemats, with pencil and watercolour views of London landmarks, which he still put on the table for every meal, as Jean would have asked him to. Her presence was everywhere in that house, even so long after her death. She had favoured heavy, ornate furnishings, which were at odds with his personality. I was surprised the house didn't depress him. It was like a funeral home. I had never yet been in his drawing room, with its flock three-piece and antimacassars, without wanting to rip out the whole lot and splash some white paint about. "She's still working for the council?"
"Sure is. She told me the Bullens have sold the old oyster farm. There's a lot of cloak and dagger stuff in the town hall about what'll go there instead." I took a sip of my tea. I hated the fancy floral teacups, too. I always wanted to tell him that I'd be happier with a mug, but somehow it would have seemed like a criticism of Jean.
"Land as well?"
"A good stretch of the beachfront, including the old hatchery. But it's the oyster beds I'm curious about."
"What can they do with an underwater stretch like that?"
"That's what I'm curious about."
There had been a time, before he got into wine, that Nino had toyed with opening his own oyster farm. He'd considered buying the Bullen place back when they were struggling against the Japanese imports.
He'd asked my father's advice, but Daddy scoffed at him and said a man who knew as little about the sea as Nino Gaines should leave it well alone. I think he might have changed his mind a little when Nino's vineyards won an award for Australian wine, and again when his turnover headed towards six figures for the first time. But he was not the kind of man to admit it. You still got designs on it?
Ah, your old man was probably right.
He downed the last of his tea and looked at his watch. Every evening he climbed onto his quad bike to ride round the estate, inspecting the irrigation system, checking his vines for botrytis bunch rot and powdery mildew, still taking pleasure in the knowledge that he owned all the land he could see.
The bay's not suitable for much. It could only really be another oyster farm.
I don't think so.
Nino shook his head.
I got the feeling he knew more than he was telling.
Well, I said, when I realised he wasn't going to elucidate, they'll have to keep the deep water channel open for the boats to get in and out, so I don't see how it will make too much difference to the crews, whatever they decide to do with it. That reminds me, did I tell you Hannah saw her first whale?
Liza finally took her out, did she?
I grimaced. No, so keep it under your hat. She went out on Moby One with Yoshi and Lance. She was so happy that night, I was surprised Liza didn't guess. Went past a door at 10:30 and she was singing along to a whale song tape.
She'll have to ease up on that kid eventually, he said. She's headed for the difficult years. If Liza tries to keep her too close, she'll pull right back the other way.
He mimed, straining at a reel.
But I don't need to tell you that.
I glanced at the clock over the mantelpiece and stood up. I hadn't noticed how late it had got. I'd only meant to bring him a cake.
Good to see you, Kate.
When I made to leave, he leant forward to kiss my cheek, and I held his arm, which might have been a sign of my affection, or a way to keep him at a distance. My dad had thought he was like all the rest, you see. He swore they were only after my fame and the hotel. It's only now I wonder at a man who couldn't let his daughter believe she was good enough to be loved for herself. When I got back, they were already out at the tables. Liza must have served them, and they sat along the bench cradling their beer and packets of chips. Yoshi and Lance were playing cards, and all were wrapped in fleeces and hats, muffled against the cool southerly wind. Apparently no one had thought to turn on the burners.
The butcher's delivery arrived, Liza said, raising a hand. She was studying the local paper. I wasn't sure what you wanted out, so I stuck it all in the fridge.
I'd better make sure he brought the right order. Last time he got it all wrong, I said. Afternoon all. You're back early.
One pod. Too far off for the punters to see much. Been off with your fancy man, Miss M?
Greg glanced at my niece as he spoke, but Liza was studiously ignoring him. I guessed she had probably not spoken to him yet, and I felt almost sorry. He had meant well, Greg, but sometimes he was his own worst enemy. When I reached the door, I found Mike Dormer in the hallway, flicking through the newspaper I leave out for guests. He looked up when I entered and nodded.
Did you get your car?
I was going to remove my coat, then figured I'd probably end up outside again.
Yep.
He pulled the keys from his pocket.
Holden. That'll do you. You feeling any more human?
He looked weary still. The jet lag, I remembered, would hit in waves.
I'll get there. I was wondering, would it be possible to eat here this evening? Eat now, if you want. I'm about to put some soup out for the crews. Grab your jacket and join us.
I saw his hesitation. I don't know why I pushed him. Perhaps it was because I felt suddenly tired myself and couldn't face the thought of laying out a whole meal for one guest. Perhaps I wanted Liza to see a male face that wasn't Greg's.
This is Mike. He'll be eating with us this evening.
They murmured hello. Greg's glance was a little more assessing than the others, and his voice carried a little further after Mike had sat down, his jokes a little more hearty. Stirring the soup, as I listened through the kitchen window, I nearly laughed at his transparency. I took the food out on two trays. I don't offer the crews any choice, I'd be there all night. Each man reached for a bowl and a hunk of bread, hardly looking up as they thanked me. But Mike stood and climbed out of the bench. "Let me help you," he said, taking the second tray.
"Struth," said Lance, grinning. "Can tell you're not from round here."
"Thank you very much, Mr. Dormer," I said and sat down beside him. "Mike, very kind of you."
"Ah, don't go giving Kathleen ideas," said Greg.
Liza looked up then and I saw her glance at him. He seemed embarrassed by all the attention. He sat down, looking somehow out of place in his iron shirt. He was probably no younger than Greg, but in comparison, his skin was curiously unlined. All that time cooped up in an office, I thought.
"Are you not cold in just a shirt?" said Yoshi, leaning forward. "It is nearly August."
"It feels quite warm to me," Mike said, glancing around him, as if at the atmosphere.
"You were like that when you first came here, Liza."
Lance waved a finger at her.
"Now she wears her thermals for sunbathing."
"Where do you come from originally?" he asked, but Liza didn't appear to have heard him.
"What do you do, Mike?"
I said.
"I work in finance," he said. "Finance," I said a little louder, because I wanted Liza to hear that. I had had a gut feeling that there wasn't anything to worry about. "A jackaroo rides up to a bar," said Greg, his voice lifting. "As he gets off, he walks round the back of his horse, lifts its tail and kisses its ass."
"Greg," I warned.
"Another cowboy stops him as he goes to walk into the bar. He says, 'Excuse me, mate, did I just see you kiss that horse's ass?' 'Greg,' I said, exasperated. 'Sure did,' says the jackaroo. 'Can I ask why?' says the cowboy. 'Sure,' he says. 'I've got chapped lips.'"
He looked around, making sure he had the table's full attention.
"Does that cure 'em?" says the cowboy. "Nope," says the jackaroo, "but it sure stops me licking 'em."
He slapped the table with mirth. As Hannah giggled, I raised my eyes to heaven.
"That's terrible," said Yoshi. "And you told it 2 weeks ago."
"Wasn't any funnier then," said Lance.
I noticed their legs were entwined under the table. They still thought nobody knew.
"Do you know what a jackaroo is, mate?"
Greg leant across the table.
"I can guess. The soup's delicious," said Mike, turning to me. "Do you make it yourself?"
"Probably caught it herself," said Greg.
"How are you finding Silver Bay?"
Yoshi was smiling at Mike.
"Did you get out at all today?"
He paused while he finished a mouthful of bread.
"Didn't get much further than Miss Mostyn, Kathleen's kitchen. What I've seen seems very nice. So, do you all work on cruise boats?"
"Whale chasers," said Greg. "This time of year we're out pursuing moving blubber of the non-human variety. But Greg's not fussy."
"You hunt whales?"
Mike's spoon stopped in mid-air.
"I thought that was illegal."
"Whale watching," I butted in. "They take tourists out to look at them. Between now and September, the humpbacks travel north to warmer waters, and they pass by not far from here. Then they pass us again on the way back down a couple of months later."
"We're modern-day whale chasers," said Lance.
Mike looked surprised.
"I hate that phrase," said Yoshi emphatically. "Makes us sound heartless. We don't chase them. We watch from a safe distance. That phrase gives the wrong impression."
If it was up to you, Yosh, we'd all be licensed marine observers of cetacea, whatever it is.
Megaptera novae anglii, actually.
I never thought about it, said Lance. It's what we've always been called out here. I thought that was why you were staying, I said to Mike. Most people only stop here for the whale watching. He glanced down at his bowl. Well, I'll certainly... It sounds like a good thing to do.
Careful if you go out with Greg, though,
said Yoshi, wiping her bread round the edge of her bowl.
He tends to lose the odd passenger. Unintentionally, of course.
That girl jumped, bloody mad woman, Greg expostulated. I had to throw a life belt overboard. Ah, but why did she jump? Said Lance. She was afraid she was about to get harpooned by Greg. Yoshi giggled. Greg glanced at Liza. Not true. Then how come I saw you taking her number later? I gave her my number, he said slowly, because she said she might want me to take out a private party. The table burst into noisy laughter. Liza didn't look up. Oh, said Lance, a private party. Like the private party you gave those two air stewardesses back in April. Mike was gazing at my niece. She was saying little, as was common, but her stillness marked her out in the exact opposite way that she had intended. I tried to see her through his eyes, a still beautiful woman who was both older and younger than her 32 years. Her hair scraped back as if she had long since stopped caring what she looked like. And you, he said quietly, leaning towards her across the table. Do you chase whales too?
I don't chase anything, she said,
and her face was unreadable even to me.
I go to where they might be and keep my distance. I find that's generally the wisest course of action.
As their eyes locked, I became aware that Greg was watching. His eyes followed her as she rose from the table, saying she needed to pick up Hannah. Then he turned to Mike, and I hoped that only I could see the wintriness in his smile. Yep, generally the best course of action when it comes to Liza, he said, his smile as wide and friendly as that of a shark. Keep your distance.
6. Mike. The bay stretches around an area of 4 miles between Taree Point and the outlying Breaknose Island, a short drive north from Port Stephens, a large port favoured for recreational activities. The waters are clear and protected, perfectly suited to water sports, and in the warmer months, swimming. There is little in the way of a tidal system, making it safe for bathing, and there is a thriving but low-level cottage industry in cetacean watching. Silver Bay is 3 to 4 hours' drive from Sydney and accessible most of the way by a major highway. The seafront is made up of 2 half-bays. One, at the northernmost point, is virtually undeveloped, and another, home to Silver Bay proper, is a short drive away, or perhaps a 10-minute walk. This supports a number of small accommodation units and retail outlets, most of whose business comes from residents of Sydney and Newcastle. There is a... I paused, staring at the screen. An existing operation ripe for redevelopment, and numerous buildings with little economic worth. It is highly likely that the owners would see a fair financial settlement as advantageous both to themselves and the local economy. As far as competition is concerned, there are no local hotels of any size or stature. The only hotel located within the bay is half its original size, having suffered a fire several decades ago. It is run on a bed and breakfast basis. There are no recreational facilities, and it would be unlikely to create a problem in terms of competition should the owner be unwilling to sell. I couldn't present anyone with this, I thought. It was all over the place. And it didn't matter how many facts and figures I had gleaned from the local planning department and Chamber of Commerce, I still felt as though I was writing about something I knew nothing about. I had discovered almost as soon as I had arrived that this was not a straightforward site. I was used to square footage in the city, executive apartments, raised 70s office blocks waiting for a new health and fitness chain, new prestige headquarters. On such jobs I could go in, look around unobserved, work out the local rental yields against property prices, the disposable income of nearby residents, and, at the end of the day, disappear. This I had known from the moment I stepped into Greg's beer-can-filled truck would be different. Here, I was acutely aware of my visibility. Even in a sweatshirt and jeans, I felt as if my lack of a salt crust gave away my intentions, and considering how empty it was, the area seemed too inhabited somehow, too influenced by its people. It was a new experience for me, but somehow I couldn't see straight. I sighed, opened a new document and began to type in headlines. Geography, economic climate, local industry, competition. I thought, with a little resentment, about my new two-seater sports car, the one I had promised myself on the back of this deal. The car that was waiting for me, paid for and polished on the dealer's forecourt. I consulted my watch. I had been sitting there for almost 2 hours and strung together three paragraphs. It was time for another tea break. Kathleen Mostyn had given me what she described as her good room, some other guests having recently departed, and the previous night had brought up a tray with tea and coffee-making equipment. She wouldn't have given it to the last occupants, she muttered, because they would no doubt have complained that the water didn't boil fast enough. She was the kind of woman who in England would have been running a school, or perhaps a stately home, the kind who makes you think age shall not wither her, sharp-eyed, fiercely busy, wit undimmed. I liked her. I guess I like strong women. I find it easier not to have to think for two. My sister would have other theories, no doubt. I boiled the kettle and stood at the window, preparing a cup. The room was not luxurious, but was oddly comfortable. The polar opposite to most of the executive-class hotel rooms I stay in. The walls were whitewashed, and the wood-frame double bed was made up with white linen and a blue and white striped blanket. There was an aged leather armchair and a Persian rug that might once have been valuable. I worked at a small scrubbed pine desk with a kitchen chair. I had the feeling, when I looked around the Silver Bay Hotel, that Kathleen Mostyn had long since decided that decorating for guests required far too much in the way of imagination, and had chosen instead to whitewash everything. "Easy to clean, easy to paint over," I could imagine her saying. I realized pretty quickly that I was her only long-term guest. The hotel had the air of somewhere that might once have been pretty smart, but had long since settled for pragmatic, then decided it didn't want much in the way of company anyway. Most of the furniture had been selected for practicality rather than some great aesthetic. Pictures were largely confined to old sepia-tinted photographs of the hotel in its former glory, or generic seaside watercolours. Mantelpieces and shelves, I had discovered, often contained odd collections of pebbles or driftwood, a touch that in other hotels might have signified stylistic pretensions, but here were more likely just the day's finds needing a home. My room looked straight out across the bay, with not even a road between the house and the beach. The previous night I had slept with the window open, the sound of the waves lulling me into my first decent night's sleep for months, and I had been dimly aware, as dawn broke, of the whalers' trucks, their tyres hissing on the wet sand, and the fishermen heading back and forth across the shingle to the jetty. When I told Nessa about the setting, she had accused me of being a jammy bugger and said she'd given her father an earful for sending me away.
You wouldn't believe how much I've got to organise,
she'd said, her voice half accusing, as if my presence in London had been of any help. You know, we could do this differently, I ventured, when she had run out of complaints. We could fly off somewhere and get married on a beach. The ensuing silence was lengthy enough for me to wonder what it was costing.
After all this?
Her voice was disbelieving.
After all the planning I've done, you want to just fly off somewhere? Since when did you start having opinions?
Forget I said anything.
Do you know how hard this is? I'm trying to work and do all this, and half the bloody guests haven't even replied to their invitations. It's so rude. I'm going to have to chase up everyone myself.
Look, I'm sorry. You know I didn't ask to be here. I'm working on this deal as hard as I can, and I'll be back before you know it. She was mollified. Eventually, she seemed to cheer up when I reminded her it was winter over here. Besides, Nessa knows I'm not a holiday person. I have never yet managed to lie on a beach for anything resembling a week. Within days, I'm scouting inland, looking at the local paper for business opportunities.
Love you, she said before she rang off. Work hard so you can come home soon.
But it was hard to work in an environment that conspired to tell even me to do the opposite. The internet connection, routed through the phone line, was slow and temperamental. The newspapers with the city pages didn't arrive until nearly noon. Meanwhile, the beach, with its elegant curve and white sand, demanded to be walked on. The wooden jetty called out to be sat on, bare legs dangling into the sea. The long bleached table where the whale crews relaxed on their return spoke of ice-cold beers and hot chips. Even putting on my work shirt that morning hadn't motivated me. I opened an email and began to type. Dennis, hope you're feeling okay. Went to the planning department yesterday and met Mr. Riley, as you suggested. He seemed to like the look of the plans and said the only possible problems were... I jumped at a knock, then slammed my laptop shut.
Can I come in?
I opened the door to find Hannah, Liza McCullen's daughter. She was holding out a sandwich on a plate.
Auntie Kay thought you might be hungry. She wasn't sure if you wanted to come down.
I took it from her. How could it be lunchtime already? That was kind. Tell her thank you. She peered round the door and caught sight of my computer.
What are you doing?
Sending a few emails.
Is that connected to the internet?
Just about.
I'm desperate for a computer. Loads of my friends at school have them.
She hovered on one leg.
Did you know my aunt is on the internet? I heard her telling my mum.
I think lots of hotels are on the internet, I said.
No, she said. She's on the internet. Herself. She doesn't like to talk about it now, but she used to be famous round here for catching sharks.
I tried to imagine the old lady wrestling with some Jaws-like creature. Oddly, it wasn't as hard as I'd imagined. The child was hovering in the doorway, plainly in no hurry to leave. She had that light, gangly look that girls get just before they burst into adulthood, the opaque quality where, for a couple of months or even years, it's impossible to tell whether they're going to be great beauties or whether hormones and genetics will conspire to pull out that nose a little too far or make that chin a bit heavy. I suspected in her case that it would be the former. I looked down in case she thought I was staring at her. She was very like her mother.
Mr. Dormer?
Mike.
Mike, when you're not too busy, if you're not too busy, one day, Can I have a go on your computer? I'd really like to see that picture of my aunt.
The sun had cast the whole bay in radiance, the shadows shrinking, the sidewalks and sand bouncing reflected light back into the air. Since I'd arrived at Kingsford Smith, Sydney's airport, I'd felt like a fish out of water. It was nice to have someone ask me to do something familiar. "Tell you what," I said, "we could have a look now." We were sitting there for almost an hour, during which time I decided she was a sweet kid. A little young for her age in some ways. She was much less interested in her appearance than the London kids I knew, or pop culture, music, all that stuff. Yet she carried an air of wistfulness and a maturity that sat awkwardly on such a young frame. I'm not usually great with kids. I find it hard to know what to talk to them about, but I found myself enjoying Hannah McCullen's company. She asked me about London, about my house, whether I had any pets. She found out pretty quickly that I was due to get married and fixed her big, dark, serious eyes on me as she asked with some gravity, "Are you sure she's the right person?" I was a little taken aback, but I felt she deserved to be answered with equal gravity. "I think so. We've been together a long time. We know each other's strengths and weaknesses."
"Are you nice to her?"
I thought for a minute. "I hope I'm nice to everyone." She grinned, a more childish grin.
"You do seem quite nice,"
she conceded. Then we turned to the important business of the computer. We looked up and printed out two different photographs of the young woman in the bathing suit with the shark, and a couple of pieces about her by people she had evidently never met. We visited the website for a well-known boy band, a tourism site for New Zealand, then a string of facts and figures about humpback whales that Hannah said she already knew by heart. I learnt that a whale's lungs are the size of a small car, that a newborn calf can weigh up to 1.5 tons, and that whale milk has the consistency of cottage cheese. I have to admit that I could have done without knowing that last one. "Do you go out with your mum much to see the whales?"
"I'm not allowed," she said.
I heard the twang of an Australian accent, noted the way that her sentence lilted upwards at the end.
"My mum doesn't like me going out on the water."
Suddenly I remembered the fierce exchange between Liza McCullen and Greg when I had arrived. I do my best to stay out of other people's private business, but I vaguely remembered that it had been something about Hannah and a boat. She shrugged, as if she was trying to convince herself she didn't care.
"She's trying to make sure I'm safe.
She looked up at me, as if wondering whether to say something, then apparently changed her mind.
"Can we find some pictures of England on your computer? I sort of remember it, but not very much."
"We certainly can. What was it you wanted to look at?" I began to type in the words. Liza McCullen appeared.
"I was wondering where you were,"
she said, standing in the open doorway. She looked from one of us to the other, and the way she did so made me feel vaguely guilty, as if I had been caught doing something wrong. A second later, I felt really pissed off. "Hannah brought me a sandwich," I said, a little pointedly. Then she asked if she could look at my computer.
"There are 23,100 web pages for humpback whales on the internet,"
Hannah said triumphantly. Liza softened. And I suppose she wanted to check out every one. There was the hint of an apology in her voice. "Hannah, lovey, come and leave Mr. Dormer alone now." She was wearing the same outfit she had had on the last two times I had seen her. Dark green canvas jeans, a fleece and a yellow storm jacket. Her hair, as then, was scraped back into a ponytail, and the ends had been bleached white, although her natural colour was much darker. I thought of Nessa, who, for the first year of our relationship, used to get up half an hour earlier than me to do her hair and put on her makeup before I could see her. It had taken me almost 6 months to work out how she had slept in lip gloss without leaving it all over the pillows. "I'm sorry if she's been bothering you," she said, without fully meeting my eye. "She hasn't bothered me in the slightest. It's been a pleasure. If you want, Hannah, I'll bring the computer downstairs and set it up for you to use when I'm out." Hannah's eyes widened.
"Really? By myself? Mum, I could do all the stuff on my project."
I didn't look at her mother. I'd guessed what her response would be, and if I didn't catch her eye, I couldn't acknowledge it. It was no big deal, after all. I unhooked the computer, having first closed all my password-protected files.
"Are you going out now?"
A thought had occurred to me. Something Kathleen had mentioned earlier that morning. "I am," I said, placing the laptop in Hannah's arms. "If your mother will take me." Given that Silver Bay's meagre economy relied almost entirely on tourism, and that, according to local government figures, the average monthly wage was equivalent to less than £1,000, you'd have thought that Liza McCullen would be glad to take out a private charter. You'd think that a woman whose boat had just cost nearly $200 in repairs, who had no trips lined up until Monday, and whose aunt had stated several times that she was much happier on the water than she was on land, would jump at the chance to take a commercial trip out to sea. Especially when I offered to pay the equivalent of 4 people's fares, the minimum the boats needed allegedly to make a trip economically viable. "I'm not going out this afternoon," she said, hands deep in her pockets. "Why? I'm offering you almost $180. That's got to be worth your while." "I'm not going out this afternoon." "Is there a storm coming?"
"Auntie Kay said it was set fair," said Hannah.
"Have you got some special knowledge about the whales? Have they gone on a day trip somewhere else? I'm not going to ask for my money back if they don't show, Miss McCullen. I just want to get out on the water."
"Go on, Mum. Then I can use Mike's computer."
I couldn't quite suppress a smile. She still wouldn't look at me. "I'm not taking you out. Find someone else." "The others are big boats, right? Full of tourists. Not my scene."
"I'll ring Greg for you. See if he's going out this afternoon."
"Isn't he the one who loses people off the side of his boat?" At this point, Kathleen had arrived and was standing on the landing, watching the scene in my room with quiet surprise.
"I'll give you a ticket for Monday," Liza said finally. "I've got 3 other people going out then. You'll have a better time."
For some reason, I had started to enjoy myself. "No, I won't," I said. "I'm antisocial, and I want to go this afternoon." Finally, she looked directly at me and shook her head, a little defiantly. "No," she said. I was aware that something about this scene had struck Kathleen. She was standing behind Liza, saying nothing, but watching intently. "Okay." $300, I said, pulling the money out of my wallet. "That's a full boat, right? I'll pay you $300 and you can tell me everything there is to know about whales." I heard Hannah's sharp intake of breath. Liza looked at her aunt. Kathleen raised her eyebrows. I was aware that the atmosphere in the room had become a vacuum. $350, I said. Hannah was giggling. I wasn't about to let go. I'm not sure what had got hold of me by then. Perhaps it was boredom. Perhaps it was her reticence. Perhaps it was because Greg had attempted to warn me off, which had made me curious. but I was going out in that boat if it killed me. $500. Here, cash in your hand. I pulled out the other notes. I didn't wave them at her, just held them in my closed hand. Liza stared at me. And I'll expect a lot of coffee and biscuits. Kathleen snorted. Your money, said Liza eventually. You'll need soft-soled shoes and a warm jumper. Not that towny get-up you're wearing, and I'll be leaving in 15 minutes. She took the money from my fingers and stuffed it into her jeans pocket. Her sideways glance at me said she thought I was insane. But I knew what I was doing. As Dennis always says, everyone and everything has its price. Liza's boat was the only one on the jetty. She walked a couple of steps ahead of me, not indulging in small talk, except with the little dog, so I had a chance to look around as we approached it. There was little in Silver Bay, even around the jetty. A cafe, a souvenir shop, whose turnover was obviously slow, the window display was dusty, and a seafood market, situated towards the main town and housed in the most modern building in the bay. It had its own car park and was a short walk away, which meant that the customers who stopped for fresh fish were unlikely to walk back to use any other facilities, a poorly thought-out decision. I would have insisted they place it right opposite the jetty. Although it was a Saturday, few people were about. The tourists, if there were any, must be out on the water in the other whale-watching boats. The few motels I saw dotted along the main road out of town forlornly advertised their available rooms, breakfast included, but the bay had the air of a place that did not expect much out of season. That said, neither did it look particularly troubled. It lacked the peculiarly sullen, abandoned aspect of an English seaside town in winter. The bright sunshine lent it a jovial air, while its inhabitants seemed uncommonly cheerful. Except Liza. She had ordered me aboard, made me stand and watch while she ran through a safety checklist in a flat monotone, then, rather grudgingly, I thought, asked me if I wanted her to put on the coffee. "Point me towards it, and I'll do it," I said. "Bend your knees when you walk around, and when you come up," she said, turning her back to me. "Don't feed the gulls. It encourages them to dive-bomb the passengers, and they mess everywhere." Then, bounding up the steps, she was gone. The lower deck had two tables and chairs, some plastic-covered benches and a glass case with chocolate, whale videos and tapes and seasickness tablets for sale. A handwritten sign warned customers that it was wise not to make their drinks too hot, as spillages often occurred. I found the tea and coffee area and made two coffees, noting the raised edges of the sideboard, the secured tea and coffee holders, presumably to stop the pots tipping off in high seas. I did not want to think too hard about the kind of seas that might send boiling coffee pots flying, the kind that apparently kept Hannah ashore, but then the engine started, and I had to hold on to the side to keep steady. We were headed out to sea at some pace. I made my way unsteadily up the flight of stairs to the back of the boat. Liza was standing at the wheel, her little dog draped across the helm behind it, obviously a favoured post. I handed her a mug and felt the wind on my face, tasted the faint tang of salt on my lips. This is just part of the job, I thought, trying to justify what I had done. But it would be an interesting one to put through on expenses. Liza's gaze was fixed on the sea, and I wondered why she had been so determined not to take me out. I wasn't aware that I had offended her in any way. Then again, she seemed like the kind of woman who instinctively rebelled against being corralled. And I had been pretty determined. "How long have you been doing this?" I had to shout to be heard over the engine. 5 years. Getting on for 6. "Is it a good business?" "It does for us." "Is this your own boat?" "It used to be Kathleen's, but she gave it to me.
Generous of her.
I can count the times I have been on a boat on one hand, so I was interested in everything. I asked her the names of a few parts of the boat, which was port and which starboard, I've always mixed them up, what you call the various instruments.
So what's a boat this size worth?
Depends on the boat.
What's this boat worth?
Does everything for you revolve around money? It wasn't said in an unfriendly manner, but it gave me pause. I took a sip of my coffee and tried again.
You come from England?
Is that what Hannah told you?
No, it's what the whale crew said that afternoon at the table, and I can, you know, hear it.
She thought for a moment.
Yes. We used to live in England.
Do you miss it?
No. Did you come out here specially?
Specially?
To do whale watching?
Not really.
Was she like this with all her customers?
Bad divorce, I speculated. Perhaps she just didn't like men.
Do you see lots of whales? If I go to the right places. Is it a good way of life?
She took her hand off the wheel and faced me, suspicious.
You ask a lot of questions.
I was determined not to bite back. I had the feeling she was not a naturally antagonistic person.
You're a rarity. I don't imagine there are many female English skippers around here.
How would you know? There could be thousands of us.
She allowed a small smile. Actually, Port Stephens is famous for them.
This, I guessed, was the closest she would come to humour.
Okay, a question for you. Why did you spend so much money just to go on a boat trip?
Because it was the only way I could get you to take me. But I didn't say it aloud.
Would you have done it for less?
I asked, changing tack.
She grinned. Of course. After that, something changed. Liza McCullen relaxed, or perhaps decided that I wasn't as objectionable or as threatening as she had initially decided, and the froideur that had hung over our trip out on the bay dissipated. We didn't say much. I sat on the wooden bench behind her and gazed out to sea, quietly enjoying someone else's competence at a skill I know nothing about. She spun the wheel, checked the dials, radioed one of the other boats, fed Millie, the dog, the odd biscuit. Sometimes she would point at a stretch of land or a creature that held some interest and elaborate a little. But I couldn't tell you now what she said, because although she was not the most beautiful woman I had ever seen, and she appeared to pay no more attention to how she looked than she did to how she spoke, and although half the time she was turned away or scowling at me, I found Liza McCullen oddly compelling. If I hadn't already worked out that she would have been sensitive to it, I would have stared at her. That's not like me at all. Nessa will tell you I'm no great psychologist. I don't care much what makes people tick if I don't need to know, but I had never met someone so determined to give away so little. Every conversational snippet dragged itself out of her. She seemed to make every personal admission under pain of torture. I asked her how she took her coffee, and she frowned as if I'd asked her about her underwear. When she told me, no sugar, it was like a confession, and all tinged with a slight melancholy. Lance says they've sighted a female about 3 miles on,
she said, after we had been at sea about half an hour.
You happy to keep going?
Sure, I said. I'd forgotten we were meant to be searching for whales. If you're not used to being on the ocean, the first thing that strikes you is the sheer bloody scale of it. It's like a landscape in itself. When you're out so far that three-quarters of your view is endless water, your eye becomes lost in its vast movement, drawn by an illuminated patch where the sun shines through cloud, or by the distant area where white horses have sprung up. I can't say I didn't feel nervous. I'm used to dry land. But once I'd got over the instability, the crashing and creaking that came from beneath my feet, I liked the aloneness, the boat's freedom to move unencumbered by other people. I like seeing Liza's face lose its tense watchfulness to take on the openness of the sea and sky. "That's where we're headed," she said, spinning the wheel, one hand raised against the glare. I could just make out the birds, dive-bombing in an area where it was impossible to see anything. "That means there are fish. And where there are fish, there are often whales." By then we had seen the others. She pointed out Greg's boat, which looked about the same size as hers, and further away what she described as Moby 2.
"There," she said. "Blow!"
"Blow what?" I queried. That made her laugh.
"There!"
I couldn't see where she was pointing and squinted. Perhaps unconsciously she took my arm and drew it towards her.
"Look,"
she said, trying to get me to focus along it.
"We'll go a bit closer."
I couldn't see a thing. It would have been frustrating, except that I was diverted by the childish pleasure on her face. This was Eliza McCullen I had not yet seen in 6 days of living at the hotel. A wide, ready smile, a lift in her voice.
"Oh, she's a beauty! I bet you there's a calf, too. I've got a feeling..."
It was as if she had forgotten her earlier chill towards me. I heard her on the radio.
"Ishmael to Moby 2. Our girl is portside to you. About a mile and a half ahead. Got a feeling she may have a calf with her, so go steady, okay?"
"Moby 2 to Ishmael. Spotted Eliza. Giving her a wide berth."
"We stay at least 100 meters away," she explained. "We make that 300 when calves are involved. It all depends on the mother. Some are curious. They'll bring the babies right up to see us, and that's different. But I always feel... I don't like to encourage it."
She looked directly at me.
"You can't guarantee that the next boat they meet is going to be as friendly. Okay, here we go."
I hung on, and, as if in some delicately choreographed formation, the three boats moved closer together until we were near enough to make out the waving passengers on board each one. The seas were quiet as the engines were turned off, and I stood next to Liza as we waited for the whale to show herself again. "Will she definitely come back up?" I needn't have asked. When that great head came out of the water, not 30 feet from us, an involuntary "Whoa!" escaped me. It's not that I have never seen a picture of a whale, or couldn't have guessed what it looked like. It's just that meeting a creature so huge, so unlikely in its own environment, throws you in a way I find hard to convey.
"Look!"
Liza was shouting.
"There it is! Look down!"
And just visible, sheltered half under its mother, I saw a flash of grey or blue, which was the calf. They went past our boat twice, then shouts from the other boats told us she had gone to look at them too. I was grinning like an idiot. When Liza smiled back at me, there was something triumphant in it, as if she were saying, "You see?" As if there was something she knew. When its weirdly long fin appeared, she laughed.
"She's waving,"
she said, then laughed harder when I found myself tentatively waving back.
"She's belly up. It means she's comfortable with us. You know, she and the baby use those pectoral fins to stroke each other."
As we sat, Liza spotted two more in the distance. I was dimly aware of the radio conversation between the three boats, the exclamations of pleasure at this unexpected haul, When she turned back to me, her face was illuminated.
"Want to hear something magic?"
she said suddenly. She nipped down into the galley and emerged with a strange-looking thing on a cable. She plugged one end into a box on the side, then threw it into the water.
"Listen," she said, flicking a few switches. "Hydrophone. There might be escorts nearby."
For several minutes there was nothing. I stared out to sea, trying to spot the whale, hearing nothing but the sound of the water meeting the sides of the boat, the wheeling birds overhead, and occasionally, brought over on a soft wind, the other boat's passengers. Then there was a low moan, drawn out, almost eerie. A sound like nothing I had ever heard. It sent shivers up my spine.
"Beautiful, isn't it?"
I stared at her.
"That's a whale?" "A male. They all sing the same song, you know. They've done research into it. It's 18 minutes long, and each year all the whales in the pod sing the same song. If a new whale comes along with a new song, they pick it up instead. Can you imagine them down there teaching each other?"
Suddenly I saw Hannah in her. Her face lit with excitement at the prospect of using my computer. I had been wrong when I said Liza McCullen wasn't beautiful. When she smiled, she was stunning. The smile evaporated.
"What the?"
It was a thumping sound. Regular. Insistent. For a moment I wondered whether it was someone's engine. But then it grew louder, and I knew it had nothing to do with the microphone. Two large boats came round the headland, strung with bunting, packed with passengers. Loud music emanated from four oversized speakers on the top deck, and even from our distance away, the clink of glasses and the hysterical laughter of the well-lubricated were audible.
"Not again," said Liza. "The noise," she said. "It destroys them. They get confused, especially the babies. And there are too many boats, you'll be frightened."
She got onto the radio, fiddling with the dial.
"Ishmael, to Disco Ship, or whatever your name is, turn your music down. You are too loud, do you hear me? You're too loud."
As we listened to the static of the radio, I stared at the water. Nothing broke the surface now. No sound could be heard above the insistent thud of the beat drawing closer. Her brow wrinkling as she realized the speed at which it was approaching.
"Ishmael to unidentified large cat, east-northeast of Breaknose Island. Turn off your engines and your music. You are close to a whale cow and calf, possibly one male,